Okay, good evening. I'll call to order the meeting of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement for March 17, 2009. We do not yet have a quorum, but I wanted to get started on some of the testimony of the two bills. Let's see, Senator Rosen, do you have your Fremont Police Chief here? Okay, you can stay there, but if your police chief wants to maybe come to the witness table and so forth, let's start with number two on the agenda, Senate File 1191, House File 1383. Senator, is Representative Gunther here too?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Gunther, did you want to take a seat at the table? Perhaps if the authors want to make some comments about the bill, then we'll have the staff make their description.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sarah Rosen,
Mr. Chair. And actually I have Jim Zarling. He's the city administrator for Fremont. And the bill basically is just extending the date. The original date was 2010. We're extending it out to 2020. And they are one of the funds that has fund themselves, basically, and they can't meet their obligation that's coming up, so they'd like to have an extension, and it should not cost the state any money, but they just want an extension on that date. So, and I have Representative Gunther, my House member, with me.
Okay. Maybe we should turn over the staff. Mr. Burek, do you want to review the issue that we have before the Pension Commission?
Members, you have a memo on this and a cover sheet. The obligation that this city would have, at least according to the most recent information I received, was a payment of about $350,000 in order to bring this organization to full funding by the current full funding date, which is 2010. As has been noted, what the bill does is it extends that amortization date in an effort to try to reduce the impact or burden, at least the immediate impact or burden on the city. In terms of the policy issues, the first one we note is whether there's sufficient need for change, and some issues there are whether this burden is sufficiently large to require some relief. And the other point that I note there is on page two of the memo, we have actuarial presentations for this organization from 1999 through 2007, 2007 being the most recent one that we have. And it would suggest that in recent years, since starting in 2003, if you look at the next to last line, the line directly above the amortization target date, you'll notice there is in several of those years a contribution deficiency, which would suggest, if the information is right in these actuarial summaries, that the city was not making the full contribution that it should have been making in those years. If that is the case, then part of the problem that the city is currently facing right now is self-inflicted. Second policy issue we note there is that there is implication for this Relief Association's 13th check. This is one of three relief associations in the state that has a 13th check mechanism, the other two being Minneapolis Police and Fire. And with the Fremont Police Relief Association, the 13th check cannot be paid unless the association is at least 102% funded. So an implication of extending out this amortization date is that if the organization achieves the rates of return that are expected in the actuarial work, the organization would not become fully funded until sometime after 2020, which means that they would not be able to pay out a 13th check to their membership until sometime after that date. The membership is fairly elderly at this point. And I note in the memo that in 2020, which would be the amortization date if the revision requested here is passed, the average age for the plan's service retirees at that point will be about 80, and the surviving spouses, the average age will be about 87. So two implications there is that few individuals will remain to ever see a 13th check. And also, we're getting quite removed from the generations that were provided with police protection by these individuals. So there's a generational issue. The next issue is the lack of a local approval provision. Right now, the bill doesn't have one. There is an amendment that could be used to add one. One reason for adding a local approval provision is so that this matter could be discussed more locally, since there would seem to be some tension between the the Fairmont Police Relief Association members, given this 13th check issue, and the city's desire to minimize the burden. That would give another opportunity to discuss that and discuss it locally. The last issue I'd mention is item six there. In 2005, the additional amortization aid provision in statute was revised, and the list of eligible recipients was reduced, and Fairmont Police was not on that list. I'm not sure if it was for, well, I'm not sure what the policy reasons were. One possibly was that about the time that revision occurred, Fairmont Police appeared to be fully funded. And since they seemed to be fully funded, perhaps it was assumed there was no need to consider them in the amortization aid provision. But I do alert members that if any change were to occur there, it would be adding one more group to the pot, which would reduce the amounts that would be that we would be able to distribute to the other recipients of that additional amortization aid. There's three amendments. The 1A is a technical clarification that was requested by the Minneapolis Fire Relief Association actuary. The 2A would allow the commission to set an amortization date other than is suggested in the bill, 2020, by filling in the blank in that amendment. And the 3A amendment would provide a local approval clause.
Okay, thank you very much. First, let the record reflect that we do have a quorum. Any questions of staff? Mr. Zarling, are you... You're the city administrator for Fairmont?
That's
okay,
correct.
Please identify yourself for the record. Do you have anything that you wish to tell the commission?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and commission members, thank you for the opportunity. I know that you have a busy and I'm sure difficult session that you're dealing with. The purpose of our request is to extend the funding date to 2010 or to 2020. Current legislation requires full funding next year. We've been contributing on average of about $345,000 a year to this fund for the past 4 years. In 2008, the contribution was $352,000, which is about equivalent to 17% of our entire police department budget. And while this has been a large obligation, we were looking forward to 2011 when the fund would, in fact, be fully funded. Unfortunately, the Relief Association's investment fund had a similar impact that many pension funds did and got caught in the downdraft of the 2008 investment market. Now, between 2006 and 2007, the fund value increased by about $378,000, and so we were looking at that $350,000 a year for each of the 3 years. In 2008, the fund's book value dropped by $330,000. And so to amortize the cost over the final 2 years would push our estimated contribution for 2009 up over $708,000, probably higher than that in 2010 because of the continued investment performance. And those amounts would be equivalent to 10% of our entire general fund budget. And so when you couple that with the local pressure on property taxes and the prospect that in that same two-year period that we would be looking at a reduction of $1.3 million in local government aid, the situation, quite frankly, becomes daunting for us. We're not requesting any additional state funding. We're simply asking for an additional amount of time to be able to take care of our obligation. I thank you for your time, and I'd be more than happy to answer any additional questions you may have.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Zarling. In 2009, the Fairmont Police Relief Association had 10 retirees and 4 surviving spouses, with the last active member retiring in 1999.
That's correct.
That's correct. And so pressing the amortization date out, what would happen, frankly, what would happen if we didn't pass any legislation? What would be the consequences?
If we didn't?
Yeah, if we did not. Nothing happened.
To try and find $1 million a year, I'm not sure just exactly how we would do that.
Okay.
Our total police budget is, I believe it's about $2.3 million, so we're looking at contributions for these 10 retirees and 4 surviving spouses to be, you know, close to half of our police department budget, and it would be very difficult for us to accomplish that.
Okay. Are there any questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps to Senator Rosner or Representative Gunther. Has this information been communicated to the Police Relief Association?
Yes, it has. Uh-huh. And is it okay for me to answer? Yes, we have the support of the Police Relief Association to extend the deadline. They recognize the burden that this would put on the local community.
And Mr. Martin, could you? What would be the consequence of nothing happening here, or what?
Members, the city administrator told you what would happen locally if nothing happened, that they'd have to dig deeper into their pocket considerably. If they elected not to make the contribution, that would disqualify them for our police state aid in the future until they are corrected that. So their option to do nothing would be to lose a sizable amount of state aid.
Senator Rosen and Representative Gunther and Mr. Zarling, have you had a chance to review the amendments or that came in the packet here?
Yes, so, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I believe the technical amendment is as it must do.
Sure, yes, okay. Senator Rosen moves the 1A amendment, which is a technical amendment that was requested, I guess, by the actuary of the Minneapolis Firefighters Relief Association. Okay, so discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The 1A amendment is adopted. There were two other ones, one to allow us to choose a different amortization date, and one, the 3A would have a local approval clause. Mr. Zarling, as a city administrator, do you have an opinion on the local approval clause? Because the bill does not have one to require the Fairmont as a city council to approve this. Is that something that the Fairmont City Council and the chief clerical officer would like to review before it becomes effective? To extend the amortization?
They have already suggested that this is the right thing to do. So, I mean, if you're talking about sending it back for council approval, if it gets approved here, that would not be a problem for us.
Chairman, I'll move the...
Okay. Senator Kahn, Representative Kahn, sorry, I insulted you. Representative Kahn moves the 3A amendment. There's a discussion on the 3A amendment.
Mr. Chair,
Sorry, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, can you tell us how much your yearly contribution is going to be if we pass this?
I don't have that information because that will depend on an entirely new actuarial valuation that will have to be completed.
And they didn't give you a ballpark?
If it's $2 million in 2 years, I'm guessing over 10 years it would be about $200,000 a year, maybe a little more than that, depending on how fast the economy comes back.
And Mr. Chair, sir, okay. you were the last amount that you paid was what?
$350,000.
Okay. So, Rosen, did you have a...
Yes, Mr.
On
Chair.
On the 3A amendment.
Yes, thank you. On that amendment, as we had talked earlier with Mr. Zarling, I understood that there was the approval from the City Council. And so is there a letter of approval, Mr. Zarling?
Well, it doesn't
matter. It doesn't matter?
I don't think it matters because it doesn't go into effect until it has local approval. And if they're confident about
the city council would have to take a vote to approve to do this.
But the fact that they took a vote previously doesn't matter. Doesn't count.
It doesn't count.
You can't give it in advance.
The state constitution, prohibits us from passing local legislation without the approval of the affected local entity. And so we usually try to have the local approval clauses just to make this satisfy the statutory or the constitutional requirement.
Except under very unique circumstances.
Under unique circumstances, sometimes we have not done that.
It's easier to take it away from Minneapolis because you just can refer to it as a city of the first class or something like that.
But if the city council of Fairmont is in support of this, I think that this is probably something that's we don't want anybody challenging the bill that we somehow bypass the constitutional requirement. So if you're okay with it and Representative Gunther's okay with it, then I don't see a problem with that. So.
Mr. Chair, if the members are more comfortable with that 3A, that's fine.
Okay, Representative Kahn renews her motion to adopt the 3A amendment. Is there discussion on the 3A amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Is there anybody else who came here to be heard on Senate File 1191, House File 1383 on the Fairmont Police extended amortization date? Anybody further? If not, Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask one question?
Representative Thiessen,
Does the extension of the amortization aid continue the state aid for a longer period of time?
Mr. Martin?
Mr. Chair, members, this organization receives no state aid.
Oh, so what the police, the insurance piece, that doesn't go there?
Well, police state aid is distributed based on the number of active police officers. And there are no active police officers in this relief association.
Okay. Thank you. All right.
Right. There are in the city if the total amount they receive is in excess of the needed contribution to para, police, and fire, they could use some of that to meet the needs, but they receive no aid specifically for this relief association.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, then Senator Rosen renews her motion that Senate File 1191, House File 1383, as amended, be incorporated in the Omnibus Pension Bill. Is there discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr.
Zarley. We do have two items on the agenda. One is a short bill dealing with the Department of Corrections plan membership modifications, Senate File 921, House File 1124. Mr. Bergstrom?
No, I do not.
Okay. I guess you're here on this one. And let's see, this is Mr. Martin. Could you tell us what this bill does?
Yes, members. In your packet, this is the Bill Senate File 921, House File 1124. Has to do with the MSRS correctional plan. It's one of two bills we have tonight on the correctional plan. This bill is a continuation of past practice where there is a recommendation from the department, either corrections or human services or both, for additions or subtractions from the membership of the MSRS correctional plan. And the proposal this came out of an internal process that reviews job descriptions and other relevant information suggests the addition of one position to the MSRS correctional plan. That position is of an auto mechanic. It has a single incumbent employee, and it's is recommending the deletion of an occupational position, auto mechanic lead, which is currently vacant from the MSRS correctional plan. The indication from the paperwork that was provided to the commission is that the individual involved is employed for approximately 79% of their working time with inmates.
There's a technical amendment here, too?
There is one technical amendment. When I drafted this, I neglected to include the retroactivity of this change to the date of hire for the auto mechanic. That's May 29th, 2007. And so the amendment, the 1A amendment would make it retroactive to that date.
And Department of Corrections, have you've had a chance, obviously, the input. Do you wish to be heard on this issue? Or does anybody wish to be heard on it? Okay. Is there anybody wish to move the 1A amendment to?
Mr. Chair, I'll move.
Okay. Representative Murphy moves the 1A amendment, and this is act to make the effective date for May 29, 2007 for this employee. Is there discussion on the 1A amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. The 1A amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
I move the adoption of House File 1124 as amended and Senate File 921 be incorporated in the omnibus bill.
Okay. And this is okay with MSRS, I take it? Mr. Bergstrom is saying yes. Okay. Is there anybody else who wants to be heard on this bill? Representative Lynch.
Senator Lynch,
I was in this room for the last couple hours. I'm burned out right now.
It must have been my outfit.
why don't we switch everybody? That's my problem. Okay.
Mr. Chair, maybe a clarifying question.
Yeah.
Staff made reference to the fact that this comes to us as with some sort of process that is regularly went through. And so I'm just pointing out that this is a very different process than what we're seeing come forward from the same area with regard to budget suggestions.
Senator Lynch, what happened was back, I guess Representative Murphy was the one who suggested that we had a lot of employees who had inmate connections that wanted the same type of opportunities to retire as the guards did. And so starting the 1990s, and we're going to hear a little bit more about this issue in a few minutes, so we started going through a process because there were a lot of employees, both with the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services, like at Minnesota Security Hospital, who argued that they should be in the plan. And we tried to sort out who should be and who shouldn't be, and we came up with a threshold saying, if as you can see in the bill, if you've had at least 75% of the working time is spent in direct contacts with inmates or patients. And so we tried to identify who those individuals were, and we basically tasked the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services to come back with an annual report as to who these people were. We've pretty much identified everybody, and now we're down to the point where they're coming in and saying, we found one person who we've identified, an auto mechanic, and actually we have another position that's vacant. But as you can see in the bill, these are the positions that we have identified over the years. This is just the latest report that's been going on for a number of years as to who the individuals are. But rather than the Pensions Commission doing the background research, we've tasked the agencies to do their paperwork. There's a process they go through, and this is their report that was put in the form of a bill to us.
Okay. Thank you.
So Representative Murphy moves that Senate File 921 and House File 1124 as amended be incorporated in the Omnibus Pension Bill. Is there further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Okay, the other item that we have on the agenda, and that's what I assume most people are here for tonight, number three is it's designated as House File 1279. Now, actually, there's two articles. This is the governor's public safety budget bill. Representative Paymar, who is the chair of the is it Civil Justice Budget Division? Public Safety Budget Division of the House, introduced the bill on behalf, as an agency bill from the governor. Representative Paymar is not here tonight because I indicated to him that, since it's the governor's proposal, he doesn't need to be here to explain it because this is coming from the administration. However, we do have somebody from the administration who is here to testify on it. And could we... We do have Paul Larson, the assistant commissioner. I will comment, the commission members have heard Mr. Larson in February when we did have some testimony from him But we have members of the public who were not here that night. So I wonder if Mr. Larson could come forward and, again, just give a description, a background of the governor's recommendation. And then we have a number of people who wanted to testify on it. We now have, as I say, and Representative Smith raised a question when we first had the testimony, as we didn't have any language. Now we do from the proposal, so at least we know what the proposal actually is. So that's why I set it on for tonight, so that we would have an opportunity for affected members of the public, employees, to testify on it and to hear, see what the issue actually is. So, Mr. Larson, welcome back to the Pensions Commission. And as I say, if you could just kind of go through the background again. I have distributed to the Pension Commission a copy of the timeline that you provided to us, as well as a letter that you had provided to the Pension Commission in 2004, because you had referenced some of that information in your earlier testimony. So we have that information before the Pension Commission now. Mr. Larson?
Mr. Chair, members of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement, I will make this as brief as I can, and actually I'm here to provide you with more updated information, which I promised the commission that I would provide at the previous meeting. But for those that weren't at the previous meeting, I'm focusing my testimony primarily in the area of the governor's recommendation of returning the correctional retirement plan to the 10-year vesting requirement, which was initially the requirement when the plan was first established back in the early 70s. In 1983, the state agreed through collective bargaining to provide an employer-paid insurance for employees in the correctional retirement plan. And at the time, the state negotiator agreed in the language that in order to be eligible for the state-paid insurance, that you had to be eligible for the pension, which at the time was 10-year vesting. Since then, the legislature has reduced the vesting requirement from 10 years to 5 years, and from now 5 years to 3 years. And initially, in my earlier testimony, it really wasn't that much of a problem back when the original vesting was reduced, because we had primarily correctional officers in the plan. We had some maintenance employees, and we had teachers that were in the plan, but the demographics of that unit back then, primarily employees, had about on average 20 plus years when they retired. But it was in 1995 when the legislature added the 500 employees and then additional 200 after that the state became aware of what we considered to be a migration of older aged employees to the correctional retirement plan. We were hearing rumors that it was very attractive because with a relatively short period of time they could get the 10 years of insurance. The insurance, by the way, is the same formula that the active employees receive. So in other words, if you're a single employee, the employer pays 100% of the insurance costs for the 10-year period of time from age 55 until age 65. If you have family coverage, it's the same as the active employee population, which currently is the employer pays 85% of that and the employee pays 15%. The restoration of the 10-year vesting would provide, I think, the relief that the administration is seeking and the costs that are associated with the insurance costs. And the last time I testified, I provided the upfront information, how many people are moving into this potential benefit right now. And at the last hearing, I testified that we currently have 164 employees in the correctional retirement plan that have less than 10 years that will be eligible for the insurance. And of that 164 employees, 38 of them has less than 5 years. So that's the front side. And so in the agreement that I had with the commission, I was asked to go back and find out currently what are we paying for employees that have less than 10 years that are currently retired for the insurance. And I do have that information. I have some documents, sure, I could hand out. I made, okay, 10 copies.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
I have a question about points 6 and 7 on page 2, where it says that the legislature reduces the vesting. Was that done because of a collective bargaining agreement?
Page 6 and 7, page 2 of the
memo.
This was a chronology of events relating to it, and it was, I believe, prepared by the corrections. I don't know. Mr. Larson, are you, do you have the cap pack in front of you?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, and I think perhaps Mr. Martin can give a better explanation, but this was something that was, I think, in response to concerns that arose as a result of combined annuities. And, you know, the general plan likewise went from 10 years to 5 years to 3 years. So I don't think there was any concerted effort to reduce the correctional plan to 3 years. This was just a phenomenon that happened.
Okay. And the legislature did it because it was an overall thing that related to several things, not just to the correctional plan.
Mr. Martin.
In 1987 and in 1989, the two vesting changes were for all of the general employee, all of the statewide pension plans, public safety or general, and also the first-class city teacher plans. Murph, I believe, is at 5-year vesting and was not there for the 3-year vesting.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the commission, the information that we have here was a challenge because we're trying to reconcile our records with our insurance division, with the Department of Corrections and Human Services, as well as the Minnesota State Retirement System. The information I have here, number one, shows that we have 180 employees that have gone through our system, which have less than 10 years for which the employer is paying for the retiree insurance. And currently, if you look at item number 2, we have 146 that are currently receiving the employer contribution for insurance, and I've broken that down by years. You can see we have one employee that's getting the insurance with less than 1 year. We have 5 employees with 1 year, 2 employees with 2 years, 14 with 3 years. We have 23 employees with less than 3 years right now that are getting that employer contribution for insurance. And that's the issue that we're trying to address with the 10-year vesting. So about the conclusion of my testimony here, we currently have 699 employees that are receiving the employer-paid insurance in the correctional retirement plan. Now, that's DHS and the Department of Corrections. Of those employees, 146 are currently receiving the employer contribution and have less than 10 years in the correctional retirement plan. The costs that we're paying for fiscal year employer year, we're in a calendar year for insurance, for 2009 is going to be $6,275,000, $13.60. Of that $6,275,000, employees who have more than 10 years of service is $4.9 million, but the employees who have less than 10 years of service annually right now, that's costing us $1,352,000. And so just looking at this, roughly 20% of our population right now that is retired, that's under age 65, that's getting the employer contribution, about 20% have less than 10 years. And when you look at the costs associated with that $6.2 million, roughly one or 25% is attributable to the costs to that. Of the retirees that have less than 10 years, if you look at the trend that we currently have of the retirees that are retired and the trends that we have of the employees that are coming down the road that will be eligible for this with less than 10 years. If you predict the trend increases of 10% each year, that $1.3 million in 10 years will be $21 million. So that's the information that I promised that I would bring back to the commission after my previous testimony, and so that's the rationale for the 10-year vesting.
And Mr. Larson, not to be clear, the decision to allow the guards initially to retire at age 55 after 10 years of service was a decision by the legislature, and then we reduced it to 5 years. We could retire at age 55, smaller pension, but, you know, after 5 years. 3 years, they could retire, again, even smaller pension. And then the decision to add other employees into the corrections plan to also retire at age 55, that was the legislature's decision. However, the decision to pay for the health care benefits has been done over and over through collective bargaining. Is it possible that this issue could also be addressed, again, through the collective bargaining process? The agreement you've got right now is the agreement you've got, but when the next round comes up, isn't it possible that the administration of the state could say, well, we're not going to pay 10 years of insurance, health insurance, for people who have 3 years of service? I mean, can't this be addressed through that process?
Mr. Chair, yes, it could. In fact, I do want to recognize that I have had some success with labor in getting this fixed, and I've had some some failures with that. And this was just when the budget crisis hit, as it was, and we were instructed to look for money under every rock we could. This was identified that clearly it was never intended that someone would get 10 years of insurance with less than a year, and that's what we're having. So, yes, it could be brought to the bargaining table, but the longer it goes that it's not fixed, we're going to be coming to you for the money.
And Representative Murphy did raise a question at the last meeting. We double-checked. Now, some of the employees who are in the corrections plan have paid more out of their paychecks to be in the plan because of the way it's structured. Moving them into another plan, have we figured out what should happen to their contributions if they were to move into another plan because they paid more to be in this one?
Mr. Chair, the way the legislation is written, those that would not be vested with the 10 years would get the refund plus 6% interest. And where we have fixed this, and as you know in my earlier testimony, we still have some labor agreements where you have to make this painful decision at age 55, and now we've got an EEOC ruling that indicates that's an age-based benefit that's discriminatory, and so we are now battling that argument, and I've tried to get rid of that use-it-or-lose-it benefit in some of our labor agreements. And so where we have made this success, we've had in collective bargaining, we've had where the employees will work beyond age 55, and they will ultimately get to the 10 years, so they do get the insurance. And it has worked out, but again, like I said, we've got some labor agreements that we've really hit the wall.
Let's see. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Larson, have you attempted to have a meet and confer about the 3 years or 5 years or 10-year vesting period?
Mr. Larson.
Representative Murphy, yes, I have. I have brought this to the bargaining table since 2001. And,
yes.
This is an insurance proposal, and we are opening up with the unions again in about, I think, a week or so, and I intend on bringing this to them again, too, consistent with what I've done since 2001.
Representative Kahn?
Well, after the last meeting, I was talking to someone, maybe from Minsky or something like that, who said the way theirs worked, some group that had this guaranteed, but they only got the percentage of it paid depending on how many years they had worked. So if you've only worked 1 year, then the percentage that it would pay would be 10% instead of instead of the, you know, the full guarantee. And what I don't remember now what system had that. Is that a possibility of doing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, that's correct. When we brought this, actually, that was in 2001, when we brought this to the bargaining unit that represents our teachers in our correctional facilities. That's a unit called State Residential Schools Education Association. There's about 100 people in that unit. And through the discussion, they asked for a graduated benefit, which was, first of all, got rid of the use it or lose it. So we got rid of the age-based benefit. And for every year you worked in the plan, you accrued 10%. And so, yes, that's a feature, and that's the only one that has that. And I do believe that one of the reasons that was is that in my experience in some of the school districts, I've seen a graduated formula for school teachers. And I think that it may have come from that thought process.
Because that seems to make a certain amount of sense to me. And then the other issue, I guess the last thing is, there's no what seems – I mean, you have this out by 55 because people aren't supposed to work past that because of the stress of working in it. And then it seems that you shouldn't have to hire someone who only has 1 or 2 years of working, that they're able to do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, that's exactly the trap that we're in right now. Yeah. You have someone that's 52 years old that knows that they get this benefit at age 55, and we cannot tell them that we're not going to hire them because they're 52 years old. And so it's created this mess for us, and quite frankly, if we do not prevail on that EEOC complaint, this is going to increase our costs by at least $150,000 a month.
After our last meeting, I did talk to a few, I think there were employees at the security hospital who came to that one, and I talked to them, and they expressed some concern that some employees might be, you know, vesting. They might have vested right now, and they may be resigning their positions because they don't want to be forced into another plan that's going to force them to work past age 55. Is this something that's information that's come back to the administration about any concerns there?
Mr. Chair, no, I haven't had no discussions about that.
I see. No, Sir Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I heard those same things expressed, that in fact perhaps a few people have already resigned in anticipation of this, and that this was maybe having unintended consequences, just having this discussion of costing the state money by having people who would have normally stayed in longer resigning before the change would be made. But the point I was going to make was that, you know, I think all of us, when we look at this and we see that someone could earn $250,000 benefit working for a year, you know, maybe have some concerns about that from a taxpayer standpoint. That just doesn't seem right. But I also would have to say that from what I'm hearing, it doesn't sound like the legislature did that. It sounds like that happened through the process of a collective bargaining agreement, and that's a contract. So from, again, kind of what I've learned here is, you know, there are some things we give more gratuitously that we can change, and that there are other things that are a contract that we really legally can't change, even if we didn't get the best deal when we made that agreement. And so I'm just wondering how, from a legal standpoint, we could retroactively or unilaterally take that away when it seems like that's a contract agreement that you made with the people who took that employment. I think there probably are some legal issues, and I wonder if you are aware of any legal support for doing that in this kind of situation.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, certainly this is going to be a challenge for us. And I had several conversations with my predecessor, Mr. Teachworth, who agreed to this language. And I said, do you realize that when you agreed to that now the vesting is only 3 years? And then to make it even worse, the way the language is written, with the combined annuity, it can even be less than that. I've seen where people have gotten this with only one pay period in the correctional retirement plan. He's sick about it. And It's something that, quite frankly, if we would have realized the migration that was going to occur about this in 1995 when we added all of those job classes, we certainly would have brought this to the commission, and I think it would have been dealt with. But it continues to grow, and that's what you need to be aware of. And it's millions of dollars, and if you know, as far as a legal challenge, I think that with some of the cuts and some of the decisions that are going to be made here, we're anticipating that. But I think it bears transparency that you have to be aware of the unintended consequences of this.
But I mean, bringing it to the commission's attention, I mean, I think we agreed that some people are in positions where they deal with people who are young and dangerous, and expect them to work in those kind of positions beyond age 55 seemed unreasonable. I mean, that was a decision that many legislatures made. The decision to provide health benefits for people who worked a short period of time was not a legislative decision, as you just indicated. So I guess trying to sort this out is problematic. So, Representative Kahn?
Well, could we, in terms of getting out of the issue of the contractual, could we stop this going forward, at least? I know it doesn't. Is that a possibility? And would that
stop the proposal?
New hires. We wouldn't deal with the existing I think this is kind of outrageous, and it's hard to see whose fault it is. But I think the idea of a percentage, I mean, it seems that there are a whole bunch of things which happened without people paying attention to what the consequences of each thing were. But the idea of taking something away from someone that they've contractually relied on is, even if they just, is also kind of a sort of negative. Can we stop it for new hires going forward? Can we at least do that?
It Representative Kahn, it seems to me the legislature could certainly do that. We could say that for new hires, and make the decision, or it could be done in the collective bargaining process, I guess. It could be done either way.
Well, it's preferable, obviously, to have it done in the collective bargaining process, but couldn't the legislature do it at least as a backup?
I don't see why we could not.
And get some language that if the problem's taken care of in collective, or we could just come back in the next ratification of the contracts and get rid of it.
Well, if the legislature did it, it just removes the issue from collective bargaining then. So
what?
It would remove the issue from collective bargaining if we passed
the
law.
Well, collective bargaining, right, but if collective bargaining has a better solution,
sure.
They could do that and we could repeat. I don't know if we could write the law that sort of said that. The only thing I seem to think that we can do, I really don't think we can do what the governor is saying we should do. But I do think we can stop it for people coming on now. Someone smarter than me can figure out what you have to write to say it. But I agree that it should be taken care of in collective bargaining because there are other things on the table that might benefit employees more. But can we write something that still leaves it open to collective bargaining? But if it's not dealt with in collective bargaining, this is what happens.
I suppose either option.
One person's nodding. Person who knows nothing less than me is
Senator
nodding.
Lynch.
Madam Chair, sorry,
all messed up tonight. we spent 2 years with Representative Murphy, so
Mr.
It's okay.
Chair,
it's okay.
I sit in this very seat for 15 hours every week addressing Senator Berglund. So, pardon me, Mr. Chair, but this. I'm very uncomfortable with the bill that's before us. I'm uncomfortable with the governor's proposal for many of the reasons that have been stated here and others. But I'm equally concerned about the legislature putting parameters on this on collective bargaining. But I wonder if something that the Pension Commission could do, though, is particularly in this case with the parties involved, Couldn't we send a directive? So it wouldn't be legislation, but send a formal response to the parties involved in this collective bargaining process with some of the concerns that have been outlined, and with a hope that that would give it a little bit stronger credence as both parties enter into their collective bargaining agreements.
Well, that, Senator Lynch, that does raise a couple of issues. I mean, first of all, the only way the legislature makes its will known is by passing legislation. I don't know to what extent the legislature wants to inject itself into the collective bargaining process. We've sometimes tried to shy away from that, but if we thought it was important, we could do that. But we certainly don't want to make a habit of doing that, because we want that process to go forward. If we don't like what happens in the collective bargaining process, the legislature ultimately decides whether or not to ratify the contract. So I guess we have to figure out where we want to be within the process. As I say, if we want a policy, we can pass it, and whatever happens in the collective bargaining process is going to be bound by what the law is.
Well, I think... I mean, saying we don't want any new employees to get it,
That could be the policy of the state.
I think it's
to get the health insurance.
Yes, just the health insurance. Yes.
Yes. With less than 10 years is what you're suggesting. I see. Okay.
I would say that. And then the point is, I guess, if they decide they'd rather have what the teachers have, this 10% a year procedure, they could come back with a proposal and we could change it, I guess.
Representative Thiessen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I just to sort out the savings, the money issue on this? There's two things going on here. One is to get rid of a bunch of employees from this plan and they're booking savings from that. And the other is the healthcare benefit side. And it looks to me like the healthcare is actually a pretty small slice of the savings you're booking. But am I reading the budget pages right about that?
Mr. Larson, I was going to ask that question too. Could you just describe what the budget impact is?
Are we making a big deal? Because I think if they really want to get rid of the health care benefits, it's the governor's responsibility and the collective bargaining to take care of it, and you shouldn't be coming to the legislature to be doing that piece of it.
Could you describe, based upon the governor's proposal, I think we've got the corrections pages in here, but describe what's the impact on the corrections budget, and I guess the human services budget, either if we adopt the governor's proposal or if we do nothing and do not adopt it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, there is a representative from the Department of Corrections from the fiscal division that can be able to explain that. And I think I would rather prefer to that. But in response to the insurance, which is, it's still, currently right now, the less than 10-year employee is costing us $1.3 million right now this fiscal year, each year. And at the rate we're going, based on our projections, we're going to be coming to you for another $21 million over the next 10 years, and you just need to be aware of that. And if we don't get this fixed. And so that's really the challenge that we face. But the other component of this is reducing the numbers on the correctional plan back to the earlier days when they were just correctional officers. And if I can, I think that would be more appropriate to have someone from the Department of Corrections.
Yeah, because, yes, it's a pension issue. It's also a budget issue, which affects the corrections budget, affects the human services budget. It's a health care issue. So although this commission does not get into the budget areas, we do have budget divisions in the House and Senate to do that. We have to be cognizant of what the impact is, because, just transferring people to one or the other, that one plan to another is easily done on paper, but it's got significant impacts here. So could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, my name is Chris Dodge. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Corrections.
Go ahead, Mr. Dodge, please.
And I can speak to the Department of Corrections change item. And Representative Thiessen is exactly right. There's two components of this. The majority of the savings are from removing more than 800 employees from the plan. Currently, we have 2,855 staff in the plan, but 806 of those are in what we call non-security positions. And The employer's contribution rate in 10 is 11.1%, and in fiscal year 11 is 12.1%, and that compares to the contribution rate of the general plan of 4.75% and 5% in those same years.
So
the immediate savings are, the majority of the immediate savings are from removing those 800 employees from the plan and reducing our employer contribution.
And when you say the non-security positions, those are the ones we've been talking about. In fact, just tonight we added one more person. So those are mainly the positions we're talking about, the people who have contacts with inmates or patients, and those are the ones that you want to or the governor suggested to be moved to the general plan. Okay.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Essentially, we're defining security positions essentially as the correctional officer series. So correctional officers 1s, 2s, 3s, corrections canine officer, corrections lieutenants, and corrections captains. Everybody else in corrections would be removed from the plan.
And the savings, I think we've got the budget pages here, but would it impact the human services budget area at all? Because I think Senator Berglund has expressed to me a concern that this could affect health care issues in her budget areas, depending on what happens here. So,
16. Mr. Chair,
I'm sorry. Yeah, okay.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that, yes, the Department of Human Services also would have an impact.
Okay. So for the corrections budget, again, if we passed it, what would be the savings to the state fund be? And if we don't pass it, what would be the impact?
If it passes as is, Mr. Chair, the savings would be nearly $6.1 million for the biennium.
Which means that would not be the savings, and that'd be the cost.
Correct.
If we do,
the majority of that, about five $5 million of that, is from the reduction in the employer contribution. The remainder is from savings in health insurance.
Okay. And are you able to discuss the effect on the human services area?
I'm really not in
okay.
a position.
Is anybody here from Human Services? Okay, just a second. Sarah Olson, yeah.
Mr. Chair, I think the numbers we're looking for are on pages 14 and 16.
Okay.
16 is the Human Services.
16 would be Human Services, yes. So that would be fiscal year 2010, it'd be nearly $2 million in 2011, $2.2 million, and so forth on. Okay. I presume for the same thing. I mean, part of it's the cost of the contributions. But as I say, I think Senator Berglund was worried, what happens to these people if they're promised their health care right now, if they're moved to a different plan, do they go somewhere else to get health care? Ultimately, I mean, you know, she wants to know just how this plays out from providing health care as opposed to the budget areas. Senator Rosen?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just reading that they would be transferred to the state's general employees retirement plan.
Okay.
And so I'd like to know the difference between the two plans.
The state general employees plan? I think that's the overall plan that most state employees, including most legislators, are in. So that's for most employees, that's the plan that they're in, as opposed to the corrections plan. Ms. Martin, okay.
Mr. Bergstrom,
did you want to? We've got the director of MSRS. he can describe it better than I.
So, is this an overall savings or is just a savings to the?
Mr. Bergstrom, welcome back to the Pension Commission.
Thank you. I actually have a packet to hand out.
Okay. Oops. Sorry. Okay.
But I think we'll help explain this a little bit.
Okay. Go ahead.
Now, Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom. I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. While the board does not have an official position on this, I would like to share some of the financial information, the impact it would have on employees, some legal concerns that we have as well. So maybe to the question that was first asked, I could use the first page of the handout as to the benefits available. The correctional plan has an age 55 full retirement with a 2.4% formula. The general plan has an age 65, 66 full retirement with a 1.7% formula. So I did some calculations to show how this would impact employees. So let's take the top one, and that's example A. Someone, all of these choose someone who has 25 years of service. So the first example is 25 years in the correctional plan, 0 years in the general plan, with an average monthly salary of $4,000. If you look at the correctional plan, you got 25 years times 2.4%, and that equals 60% of the high five monthly average of $4,000 to generate a monthly benefit of $2,400. Since this person has no general plan coverage, that is what the monthly benefit amount would be. So the formula is different, and the full retirement age is different. If you look at example B, I took then kind of pretending that this bill passed and went out now 15 years. So if somebody then had 15 years in the correctional plan and 10 years in the general plan, now they fall under combined service. So we have in the correctional plan the same high five of $4,000 a month. 15 years times a 2.4 is 36%. So that piece of their service would generate $1,440. Then if you move over to the right, this person would have 10 years of service in the general plan. They would share the same high five. Under combined service law, they use the same high five. Those 10 years at 1.7 is 17%, and that would generate $680. However, since this plan has full retirement at 65 or 66, we apply a reduction. That reduction is about 43%. So we'd lower that benefit to by $292, and that would generate $388. When you add the two together, it would come out to be $1,828 a month.
And could you explain why the reduction would be necessary at age 55? Just you understand it.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, the way the general plan works, it is geared more towards full retirement at 65, and we have what's known as an actuarial reduction in benefits. And an actuarial reduction is roughly 5% a year, depending on how long they are. So this whole plan is geared on this. People hired before July 1 of 89 do have a rule of 90, which I did not factor in here, because a lot of that wouldn't apply. But that plan, the idea behind the general plan is geared for 65 retirement. The correctional plan is more geared to a 55 retirement.
Okay.
If you look at example C, now this is someone whose all of their service is in the general plan. So the correctional plan would generate zero. The general plan now, 25 years times a 1.7, would be 42.5%. If this employee worked till age 65, then we would pay them the $1,700 a month that we show there. But if they retire at 55, we would apply a 43% reduction, and the benefit would be $969 a month. So there is a sizable difference in the benefit that's payable, and that's kind of an example of how the calculations work.
Okay. Any further questions? And you have some other documents that came with your package. Do you want to describe what they are?
Yep. Mr. Chair, if I could just talk briefly. I know you've got other people to talk. And I want to clarify, this bill does two things. Okay. It takes about 1,500 employees out of the correctional plan, and for prospective service moves them to the general plan. Okay? It also then increases vesting for current employees to 10 years. And I want to make it real clear that there is no reason why the 10 year that they use for, or the 3 years they use for health care, is tied to our vesting schedule. Okay, we have 3 year vesting. We have had 3 year vesting since 1989, and you've discussed that. But I do think the vesting inflicts great pain on many of our employees, and we have some concern about that. A, I think because it applies to current employees, I think you would be very open to a lawsuit. And based on the discussions I've had with my attorney at the Attorney General's office, he thinks the state would be in a very bad position to win that.
If this is adopted.
If the 10-year vesting is adopted.
Okay.
Yep. And so there are some legal issues that I think should be reviewed before this passes, especially regarding the vesting. The other issue with vesting is the idea behind both private and public pensions is to make pensions more accessible. and we're going the opposite direction. Back in 1989, 1987, we were recognizing a lot of people were paying into our retirement plans, never having the 10 years of service, sometimes 20 years of service to qualify, so we lowered that vesting. For private pension plans covered by ERISA, they require 3 or 5 year vesting. Now you're saying for this plan, it's going to be different than most of our other plans and move that to 10. Why we are not covered by ERISA, because we are a public plan, we certainly think that's a best practice, and we also think a shorter vesting schedule is a good policy, because we're trying to make pensions more available to more people, and I think that's a very important thing. So we have very serious concerns. One of the examples here that is kind of even not even being discussed, we have 411 people who are in our general plan right now who have prior correctional plan service that don't have 10 years of service. Upon passage of those bill, those 411 people will have virtually no value other than a refund of their contributions rather than ongoing monthly benefits. So we are very concerned about the vesting. We think it sets a bad policy. I'm certainly not an attorney, and I think it would be good to check with your legal counsel for doing that. In your package, I have attached a letter from Mercer, who is our actuarial firm, regarding vesting and sort of the history of vesting. Keep rolling?
Keep rolling. Yeah.
Okay.
Run a roll.
Okay. If it is determined that vesting is not legal, and again, I'm not an attorney, but I have talked to the Attorney General's Fund, you then would be left moving people from one plan to another. If you look on your last page of the handout, and I have the actuarial documentation in front of that, I just want you to be aware of the financial impact. So your very last page, it's called Governor's Recommendation. It's a one-page sheet. What happens when you take employees out of a pension plan? You have a smaller salary base in which to pay off the debt. This plan is about 76% funded. Okay? So if you take and lower those people or move that group out, it drives up the cost of our correctional plan, probably will drive up slightly the cost of our general plan. And I could kind of liken it to this, is let's say we all owned a house together. And this half of the room used a lot of water and a lot of electricity and a lot of food. You know, we might save money on an ongoing cost, but if that half of the room decides to bail out, this half of the room still has to pay off the mortgage. That impact of moving that increases contributions to the correctional plan, to those remaining people in the correctional plan, by 2.3%. So now the cost would go up for that group of people. So what I did, and I hope these numbers are right because I did them late and I can't say they're perfect. So the total, if you look down this page, they are moving out the non-security personnel on the right. So the idea behind this proposal of moving this group out was to save money on their employer contributions between the correctional plan and the general plan, which it certainly does. So they have a payroll, and this is both DHS and correctional combined. I did not break them out. They have a payroll of about $71,936,000. In July 1 of this year, they will start paying 11.10%. So their total contributions to the plan would be $7,984,896. So that's kind of current law. That's what's going to happen if nothing is done. If they are done, if this bill does pass, now they would pay into the general plan, which is going to have a 4.75% contribution rate, and that would be $3,416,960 for a total savings of $4,567,936. So that is what it appears is being saved. However, when you factor in the increased cost to people staying now in the correctional plan, that drives the cost up of that plan by 2.3%. If you look then, not to go through the math, on the left side at the very bottom, that has an additional cost for the security personnel of about $3 million. When you net those, that savings in one plan and the cost on the other, you end up with about a net savings in 1 year of about $1,495,113. The largest portion would be the Department of Corrections. The other part would go to DHS, and I did not bring that out.
Sure.
So what is happening by doing this is you are moving people, but you now have a higher cost in the correctional retirement plan that has to be covered.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was taking a look at this proposal and looking at what our principles are supposed to be, and I just would call our attention to two things. And this is principle number 22. In recommending benefit plan modifications, the imposition of reductions in overall benefit coverage for existing pension plan members should not be recommended. Goes on further to say, the imposition of a reduction in overall benefit coverage may be imposed for new pension plan members in order to achieve sound pension policy goals. And so, Mr. Chair, in light of the pension principles, in light of the legal questions that certainly are paramount in this case, frankly, I'm not sure how much additional time and energy this commission needs to expend on this particular piece of legislation before us tonight.
Well, Senator Lynch, I can appreciate that. I think we've all been contacted by people who are concerned about this issue, wanted to learn more, and I wanted to give an opportunity for people, you know, to testify. And, you know, I hope to do that. Ultimately, as I say, this issue is not within the complete province of the Pension Commission because it does cross a lot of jurisdictional areas and some committees that, you know, a lot of us serve on. So, I don't anticipate any votes being taken tonight. I recognize people may have other things they need to do. But I made a commitment that I would let people testify, and I'll certainly honor that promise that I made to give them the opportunity. They're here tonight, and I would like them to testify. So, but as I say, we'll not take any votes. Sarah Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the comments about vesting and wanting to encourage early vesting. But I was just going to point out that I think the thing about the health insurance that bothers me personally and maybe some of the others is it being maybe not a very good bargain to have made is because it isn't like vesting in a pension plan where your years of service are getting you a percentage of the benefit. And so you're not suddenly getting 100% windfall for just working somewhere in a short period of time. You have to factor in the number of years you work at a certain percentage, and that's not what's happening with the health insurance, you know, where that would be like getting 100% benefit for the same benefit for working 25 years, say, as working 1 year, and that's kind of the problem, I think, with the health insurance, that it doesn't seem right. But that being said, so I guess I'm just saying I don't certainly have a problem with the idea or want to lengthen the period of time it would take to vest in something that's going to build over time. But I agree. I don't think we can do anything about the health insurance because that's not a law. That was a collective bargain made, and I think we all are concerned about that. I think it needs to go back to the collective bargaining table to see what can be done, if anything, about it.
And unless there's any other question, Mr. Dodge, I don't think you need to stay at the table any longer than you have to. But, Mr. Bergstrom, do you have anything further you want to bring to our attention?
Mr. Chair, just there are some technical issues that we have with the bill that if it does move forward, okay, we would like to clean up.
Okay. Any other questions, Mr. Bergstrom? As I say, I did want to give some people the opportunity to testify, and I have a
Mr. Chairman.
Of people. Oh, sir, Representative Smith.
Well, Mr. Bergstrom is still at the table. Number one, I heard you say that there would be no votes tonight. Therefore, I assume the Senate and the House can do with this proposal what it will within their own time frames and their own committee process.
Representative Smith, since it affects other areas, for instance, you know, the language we have in here is in the House Public Safety Budget Division. I'd kind of like to get some indication as to what the appropriate budget divisions are going to be doing before we take any action on it. That just seems appropriate because there's so many budget issues that affect it. If there seems to be an interest within the legislative process to do something, whether it's what Representative Kahn suggested or what the governor suggested, you know, then certainly this commission has a responsibility to do something. I don't think we're quite at that point tonight, but I wanted to have some opportunity to vet the issue in case it comes up and we're prepared for it. So.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the last thing I the last thing I would like to comment on is I don't think it's helpful to hear a witness testify here. I don't think it's helpful to the quality of the testimony to hear comments such as, I'm not an attorney, but I've spoken with an attorney, especially if it's in the Attorney General's office or any attorney. I don't think it's good for the quality of the testimony. Secondly, I don't think it's good to have a public record of potential comments made, hearsay, that some attorney in the Attorney General's office may have made. So I would just like to vent that, if you will, that comment for purposes of this witness and anyone else.
And point well taken, Representative Smith. And, in fact, I guess if we do get further into it, I guess I would like to hear from what the Attorney General's office has to say, and we will get them in here. They're not here tonight, but we can find out if that's the will of the commission.
Thank you.
Anything further? Sarah Lynch?
Mr. Chair, just a point of clarification. I'm a little unclear. Was Representative Smith, were you indicating that perhaps in one or more bodies, in one or more committee, there might be some action taken on this particular piece of legislation? And if so, in the budget division that I serve on, we had a little bit of this discussion, and it was, I guess it wasn't a formal position of the division, but it was, there was some comfort in knowing that this legislation was going to fall to the Pension Commission because of the ability of this commission, unlike an individual budget division, to look at the overall policy implications. And so, Mr. Chair, could you clarify, are individual divisions going to be potentially acting on parts or all of this? And
well,
sounds a little convoluted to me.
As I say, there's so many interests around here because it's a corrections issue, it's a human services issue, it's a health care issue, and so forth. Speaking for the Senate side, I would think that if Senator Higgins in the Public Safety Budget Division were to say, yeah, we've gone over our budget as far as we can, and we really need this $6 million in savings, we're going to have to do this. And if that's what she reported back, you know, to me, I'd say, well, I guess the Pensions Commission is going to have to figure out, you know, if that's good policy to make it work and so forth. And if Senator Berglund feels that, you know, this has an impact and we have to do this in order to make the human services budget work, you know, obviously the Pension Commission is not bound by it. Likewise, I would certainly respect whatever the House process is if they are looking at it. But given the fact that this does affect some budget, I don't know that, I mean, I think they'd be a little irritated if we were to, I don't know, say adopt it. Let's say we went ahead and adopted it and without even knowing or consulting with what they want to do. Likewise, if we reject it out of hand and say we're not going to do it, that may affect other decisions too. I think what we need to do is maybe gather some of the stakeholders together, you know, within the legislative process, you know, the chairs, the lead minority members, and so forth, and ask them, you know, what do you think we ought to do? And maybe we ought to have a meeting, you know, within the respective bodies, you know, to sort those things out. You know, I mean, I've tried informally to talk within the Senate about that, but you know, there's not been a formal meeting to do that, and maybe we're getting to the point where we better start talking about that. So, and the House, I would imagine, would go through a similar process. I don't know, Representative Thiessen.
I mean, to this point, it seems to me that there's a bill here around health. There's an issue here around health insurance investing that Senator Olson and others have identified, and that vesting period, which I'm not sure is actually directly addressed in this legislation. I don't think they talk about that. That may be a budget savings thing, but the language of this bill is pure pension policy. And I don't see how I think we should take a vote on it and send a signal to Senator Higgins and to Representative Paymar that we don't think this should be part of their discussions or it should be part of their analysis, because there's really serious pension issues that no one else is going to get. Well,
Representative Thiessen, I may have spoken out of turn because I said we would not take a vote. I guess that was my hope and intention, but I can't control that. If any member of the Pension Commission makes a motion, you know, it's an order to make that motion.
And I would just say there may be a way, you know, I don't know. I think the discussion is largely around how we deal with this issue of the what's in the collective bargaining agreement or not on the vesting for the health benefits. But that's not really directly, that's not a pension issue in some sense. Yeah. And so we may be able to work that out.
You are correct, Representative Thiessen. The language that we have from Representative Paymar's bill is strictly pension language. And if it went anywhere, I suppose it would go in the pension bill. But it happens to be in the public safety budget bill submitted by the governor. So
can I ask one more question of the representative of corrections?
Sure. Mr. Dodge, could you come back?
I'm sorry. The first person that was here.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Larson.
Okay.
Is he with
Minnesota Management Budget.
Yeah, I need corrections. And I guess my question is, whoever can answer it, if we weren't facing this budget deficit and the governor wasn't looking for savings, would this have been proposed as policy by the governor?
That's a hypothetical.
As a matter of pension policy, would this have been proposed?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, I believe that we have uncovered, in my opinion, an unintentional windfall since 2001, where people are getting insurance with a relatively short period of time. I don't think whether there was a budget shortfall or not, we would continue to try to fix that.
Well, and Mr. and Sir, I do see you have a letter in here dated back from 2004 related to that. But again, that's not a pension issue. That's an issue that the health care issue is an issue that came through collective bargaining. That's not a pension issue before us. The question is getting dropping all the non-security personnel off, which is unrelated, I think. I mean, to your question, a security person could come in for that 1 year, bump into that position, you know, arguably. So I guess the question, I think we need to kind of maybe parse the question more closely. First of all, would there be a proposal coming from you outside of this budget circumstance, just as a matter of pension policy, to move those people out of the correctional plan and back into the general plan?
Mr. Larson?
Mr. Chair,
Are you trying to justify it? You're not.
No,
okay.
I'm here really to just identify the – and I do think, though, that, again, at the risk of repeating myself, when this insurance was provided – it was based on the eligibility for the annuity, and when someone said, let's go from 10 years to 3 years, I don't think they caught it, and now we've caught it, and we're exposing it. That's
and
if you want to pay it and continue to do it,
And, sir, that's, a little bit of a Mr. Chair, a separate issue again, and I think we keep bumping those two together. And so I'm asking some very specific questions, I guess. So it sounds to me like at least the moving the people from the corrections, this non-security people, as they're called, which, you know, we added another one again, as the chair recommended tonight, through which the corrections department, you know, suggested, I guess, through their process. As a matter of pension policy, and I guess the other thing as a matter of pension policy, setting aside the health care benefit piece, you wouldn't have been suggesting we change the vesting period for the pensions themselves. Would that be correct? And maybe you're not the right person to answer, but it strikes me that no one's made an argument from pension policy that reducing the vesting period outside of this issue of whether people can get these 10 years of health benefits makes sense. And in fact, Mr. Bergstrom, I hear saying it's actually perhaps a bad idea as a matter of policy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's probably correct. I think if we were to... because we're still at the three-year vesting for the other plans, but they don't have the insurance, and we didn't tie the insurance to the eligibility. That's where the problem came.
Well, Mr. Chair, and we can hear from the other witnesses, my suggestion, I'd actually like to vote on this as a matter of pension policy.
Yeah. As I said, if there is a motion, it's an order. I mean, what I said was my opinion, but no, a motion would be in order. There are some people who did ask to testify. I'd like to invite them to do so, but I also like to suggest that if they to listen to what the people ahead of them are saying, and please be succinct and be brief in your testimony. If you hear somebody saying something that you intended to say, you don't need to repeat it again. I mean, we want to hear the concerns that people have, but you know, we don't need to hear the same point over and over and over. So I will tell you the people who have asked to be heard tonight, and let's see, Chad Schmidt, the representing the State Residential Schools Education Association, is he here? Welcome, come on forward. Welcome to the panel. And I'll read the names and the others. If you could come up right now, that would help. Tammy Hughes and Imo Kalla from the Minnesota Nurses Association. If you could come up to the witness table, as I say, we'd like to keep moving as we can. So please identify yourself for the record. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, would you be open to entertaining a motion at this time?
If you wish to make a motion, you may do so.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate File 921, House File 1124.
Senate File. Well, no, that's the membership modification.
Oh, sorry.
So that was item one. We already did that.
Okay.
As amended. That's adding one
Chair.
Person to the plan. Okay. This is it would represent Paymar's bill.
File 1279.
Articles 3
Senate
and 4.
File XXX, House File 1279.
That is the. Yes, that is the issue that we're talking about. You have a motion? Sir, what your motion is? To adopt it?
No.
No.
What is your motion?
The motion
should be to adopt it.
And then you vote on it.
Okay, your motion is to adopt it. Okay.
So moved.
Okay, is there discussion on the motion to adopt House File 1279? There's no Senate companion. Is there discussion on that motion?
Did we want to hear their testimony?
Well, there's a motion before us. And
well, you guys do it differently in the Senate, I forget.
Yeah, there's
okay.
discussion on the motion. Well, there's a joint commission. I mean, if...
Yes. No, you're right.
Well, I would think you'd hear the testimony, but...
Pardon me?
They don't hear testimony after they make their motions in the Senate.
There's a motion before us, and I'd like a discussion
on the motion. We don't get testimony until we make our motions.
Well, but there's now a motion before us.
Okay.
There is a motion before us. There's a discussion on the motion. Hearing none, the question occurs on the motion by Senator Lynch to adopt House File 1279. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Those opposed?
No.
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 Motion does not prevail. Okay. That sort of moots out a lot of the work that, all the work you had prepared in your remarks. So unless something happens, we don't have an issue before us at this moment. So anything further to come before?